Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling, well, a really profound and honestly necessary book. It forces us to look squarely at the end of life, but in a way that actually helps us think about how we should live right now.
Absolutely.
We are plunging into Dr. Atul Gawande's incredible book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End.
Yeah, and this book, it's just essential reading for everyone, really, not just doctors or nurses.
Right.
It challenges the basic ideas, the fundamental assumptions of our modern care systems.
How so?
Well, Gawande argues that our system, you know, with its incredible focus, almost a singular focus on just prolonging life.
Fighting death at all costs.
Exactly. That focus often completely fails. It fails to help people live well and ultimately die with dignity.
We get so caught up in the technology, the treatments.
We do. We're so good at fighting disease, technologically speaking, that we seem to have forgotten the basic human need for purpose, for autonomy.
That's the real heart of it, isn't it? The tension.
It is.
So our mission for this deep dive, for you listening, is to pull out those core insights. How can we actually reshape our approach to getting older, to mortality?
Yeah, how do we shift things?
How do we prioritize, you know, human flourishing, that
right.
sense of purpose, of control,
yeah.
over just, well, mechanical survival?
And I think the biggest insight, the real paradigm shift he calls for, is this. The goal isn't some kind of idealized good death.
Okay.
It's actually about fighting to enable a good life for as long as possible, right to the very end.
That reframing changes everything.
It changes every decision for the yeah. patient, the family, the doctors, everyone involved.
So to really get the weight of this critique, we need to understand who's delivering it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Dr. Atul Gawande himself. His authority here is kind of unique, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. He's got this really interesting position. He's a practicing surgeon general in endocrine at Brigham and Women's in Boston.
A top hospital.
Right. And he's a Harvard professor, and he's a celebrated staff writer for The New Yorker.
So he's deep inside the medical world.
He is the quintessential insider, a surgeon trained, you know, to fix things, to intervene, solve problems with a scalpel. And yet here he is critically examining the limits of his own profession. It's like a general stepping back from the battlefield and saying, hold on, maybe our whole strategy is flawed.
That takes courage.
It does. And his writing, it blends that rigorous clinical observation with this really deep, reflective, humanist perspective.
And it's not just clinical observation, right? There's a personal element too.
Oh, absolutely. That's crucial. The book weaves his research together with the very poignant, very personal story of his own father's final years. His father had a debilitating spinal tumor, and Gawande navigated that experience, giving him this dual perspective. He was the highly trained doctor.
Right.
And also the anxious, sometimes helpless, family member. It forced him to confront the massive gap between what medicine can technically do
and what a human being actually needs.
Exactly. What matters most to the person.
And that experience, I imagine, leads directly into the book's main argument.
Straight into it. The central premise is this idea of the medicalization of aging and dying.
Medicalization, meaning?
Meaning we've taken these universal human experiences, getting old, facing death, and we've turned them into technical problems, problems for medicine to solve.
Like aging is just another disease to be cured.
Pretty much. Instead of seeing it as a natural chapter of life, a phase to be lived maybe differently, but lived nonetheless.
Okay, so we treat it like a technical problem. What's the downside? What are the consequences, he points out?
Well, the consequences are often devastating, especially within the institutions we built for this purpose. Think hospitals, nursing homes.
Yeah.
He details how these places, even with the best intentions, often focus squarely on physical safety.
Keeping people from falling, managing meds.
Exactly. But in doing that, they often strip elderly and dying people of the very things that make life worth living. Their autonomy, their control over their own lives, their sense of purpose, their connections, their community.
So survival becomes the only goal.
It becomes the sole metric of success, yeah. Even if the quality of that survival is, well, minimal or even miserable.
Wow. So the book's purpose then is to shine a light on these failures.
Yes, to illuminate them, but also crucially to propose alternatives. real, tangible models that work better.
Like what?
Things like palliative care, which we'll get into, and also innovative approaches to elder care facilities. Designs focused not just on keeping people alive, but on honoring their individual priorities, their values.
Who's the audience for this? Is it just for doctors?
Not at all. Honestly, the audience is everyone. Anyone who will ever care for someone else or eventually need care themselves, which is pretty much all of us.
Okay, let's dive deeper then. Let's get into the specifics. You mentioned the critique of institutional care. Where does he start with that?
He starts by looking at the history, how we got here. He traces the rise of nursing homes, which actually evolved from older institutions like almshouses.
Okay.
But after World War II, they became increasingly medicalized. The focus shifted. Institutional rules, driven by concerns about liability, hygiene, efficiency, they took over.
And safety became paramount.
Safety and efficiency above all else. Yeah. And that laser focus on safety, while understandable on one level, had this crushing human cost.
What kind of cost?
He talks about these devastating unintended consequences. Reformers identified them as the three plagues of institutional life.
Three plagues? That sounds dire.
It is. They are. Loneliness, helplessness, and boredom. Think about that. An existential sickness, really.
Loneliness, helplessness, boredom. Yeah, I can see how that would be soul-crushing.
Absolutely. When you strip away someone's purpose, isolate them from real relationships, give them zero control over their day, the suffering is immense, even if they're physically safe.
That sounds just awful. But you said he offers alternatives. He contrasts this.
Yes, thankfully. He highlights some truly revolutionary solutions. Take Karen Brown Wilson. She's basically the architect of what we now call assisted living.
Okay, assisted living. How is that different philosophically?
It's a fundamental shift. Wilson's vision was a radical rejection of that default institutional model. Assisted living was designed around maintaining autonomy.
Oh.
Simple things, really. Residents should have private apartments, a lock on their own door, control over their daily schedules when they wake up, eat, what they do.
That sounds normal, like regular life.
Exactly. The philosophy shifts from providing rigid care, where the institution dictates everything, to offering assistance, helping the individual live their life on their terms, even if that means accepting some small, manageable risks.
Risk becomes part of living again, not something to be eliminated at all costs.
Precisely. And then there's the Eden alternative. This was created by a physician, Bill Thomas, and it seems almost even more radical in how simple it is.
The Eden alternative. What did Dr. Thomas do?
He looked directly at those three plagues: loneliness, helplessness, boredom, and he realized the answer wasn't, you know, better procedures or more medication.
Okay.
The solution was profoundly human. It was about bringing life, actual vibrant life, back into the nursing home environment.
How? What kind of life?
He introduced children, animals, and plants. Lots of them. Parakeets, dogs, cats, hundreds of plants, gardens, a childcare center integrated into the facility.
Wow. Seriously, animals and plants.
Seriously. Suddenly, the residents had this vibrant life all around them. But crucially, they also had something or someone to care for, a reason to get up, a sense of purpose.
That connection, that responsibility.
It made all the difference. He saw massive improvements in well-being, both physical and emotional. Less depression, fewer prescriptions needed. It was transformative.
That's incredible. It shows how much we underestimate those basic human needs.
Totally. And this failure, this institutional failure to respect autonomy in elder care, it just gets magnified when we look at how medicine often handles terminal illness.
Ah, so this connects to the end of life care part of the book.
Right. He really turns the focus onto the medical culture itself in the chapter called Letting Go.
Letting Go. What's the critique there?
It's a really sharp critique of what he calls the fight at all costs mentality. Medicine is incredibly good at intervention, right?
Yeah, that's its strength.
So its default mode is often to just keep intervening, administer aggressive, often painful treatments, more chemo, risky surgeries, long past the point where a cure is realistically possible.
We confuse fighting with caring.
That's a great way to put it. We confuse the act of fighting the disease with the act of caring for the person.
But hang on, if you're a doctor, and there's any chance, even a tiny one, don't you have an obligation to offer that treatment? How does he navigate that tension?
That's the absolute core of his argument about communication. He says the biggest failure isn't necessarily offering the option, it's the failure to communicate honestly about it.
Honestly about what?
The odds. About the odds, yes, but more importantly, about the cost of that option. Not just the financial cost, but the cost in terms of quality of life. What will this treatment do to the patient's ability to live meaningfully, to maintain their dignity, their purpose?
So the failure is not framing the trade-offs properly.
Exactly. The solution, which he learned from palliative care experts like Dr. Susan Block, isn't just about knowing when to stop treating. It's about shifting the entire goal of the conversation.
Shifting the goal from cure to what?
To understanding the patient's priorities as a whole person. This leads directly to what he calls the necessity of hard conversations.
Hard conversations. What does that look like? How does a doctor do that?
It means the doctor has to fundamentally change the questions they ask. Instead of just focusing on the disease, your tumor is growing, we can try this drug, they need to focus on the person.
Asking about
their fears, their hopes. What makes a day good for them? What level of function are they unwilling to lose? What trade-offs are they willing or unwilling to make for the possibility of more time?
So you establish those values before you discuss specific treatments.
Yes. Before the patient is maybe too sick, too overwhelmed, or too sedated to really articulate what matters most to them.
That takes real courage. On both sides, doctor and patient.
Enormous courage. But he argues it's absolutely essential if we want to achieve a good life right up to the very end.
Okay, let's try to distill this down. What are the main themes, the core messages that we as listeners should really take away from being mortal?
I think there are three big ones. First, the primacy of autonomy over safety.
Autonomy over safety. Explain that a bit more.
Gawande argues, really convincingly, I think, that a life completely stripped of risk, you know, the totally sterilized, regulated life we often impose on the frail elderly, is often a life stripped of joy and meaning.
Yeah, I can see that. We try so hard to prevent every possible fall or mistake.
Right. We lock doors, we restrict activities, we take away choices, all in the name of safety. But we might be taking away the things that make life feel worth living. He points out that many elderly people would actually prefer to accept certain calculated risks.
Like being able to walk outside alone, or keep a pet, or manage their own schedule.
Exactly. If it means maintaining control, maintaining purpose, maintaining their sense of self.
It forces you to ask, where's the line? Our instinct is often so paternalistic, wanting to protect above all else.
It is. And Gawande challenges that instinct, reminding us that meaning often lies in self-determination, even if it involves some risk.
Okay, so autonomy over safety. What's the second theme?
Second theme, quality over quantity of life. This becomes especially critical when curative treatments are no longer on the table.
Right, when the focus shifts from getting better.
We have to redefine hope, holding on to a false hope for, say, years more life when that's medically impossible.
Mm.
It's not helpful.
So what does hope become?
Hope becomes more immediate, more attainable. It shifts. Maybe it's hope for a good day today, or hope for freedom from pain, or hope to be clear-headed enough to talk to my grandkids.
Hope for meaningful moments rather than just more time.
Precisely. Redefining hope gives purpose and focus back to the time that remains.
Makes sense. And the third theme.
Theme three brings us back to that crucial action step. The necessity of hard conversations. And this isn't just for doctors talking to patients. This is for all of us.
For families. For ourselves.
Absolutely. Confronting our own mortality or helping loved ones confront theirs requires clarity. We have to talk about our fears, our hopes, our goals for the end of life.
And the trade-offs.
And especially the trade-offs we're willing to make. What matters most? What abilities are non-negotiable? These things need to be discussed before a crisis hits.
So if you can't speak for yourself later, your wishes, your values are already known.
Exactly. It's probably the single most important takeaway for listeners.
One of the things that makes Gawande's work so impactful is just how well he writes. He distills these really complex emotional ideas into memorable language. Are there any particular quotes that stand out?
Oh, definitely. There are so many powerful lines. One that really captures the whole shift in perspective is this. We've been wrong about what our job is in medicine.
Okay.
He says, we think our job is to ensure health and survival, but really it is larger than that. It is to enable well-being.
Enable well-being, not just survival. That's huge.
It's a total redefinition of the mission, from fixing the biological machine to nurturing the whole person.
Oh, any others?
There's another one that uses this striking metaphor of medicine as a kind of war against death.
Right.
He says, the simple view is that medicine exists to fight death and disease, but the enemy has superior forces. Eventually, it wins.
That's blunt.
It is. And then he concludes, and in a war that you cannot win, you don't want a general who fights to the point of total annihilation.
Oof. That's powerful. It's a plea for wisdom, really, knowing when fighting stops being helpful and starts being destructive.
Exactly. Knowing when the goal needs to shift from fighting to comforting to enabling that well-being we just talked about.
So this is all incredibly thought-provoking, maybe even a bit overwhelming. How do we actually apply this? What are the real-life applications for us right now?
Well, for families, the book is basically a roadmap. It gives you permission and tools to start those essential conversations that, let's be honest, most of us avoid.
How do you start? It feels so awkward.
The most practical tip is to use the framework that Gawan himself learned from palliative care experts. You don't have to invent the questions.
What are they?
Sit down with your loved ones, your parents, your partner, even document it for yourself and ask those key questions. What are your fears about what might happen? What are your hopes if time becomes short? What trade-offs are you willing to make? And what would a good day look like for you, even now?
Why focus on fears and hopes rather than asking, like, do you want CPR?
Because the treatments, CPR, ventilators, feeding tubes, they're just tools. They're secondary. What matters are the values that guide whether those tools should be used.
Ah, okay.
If someone's greatest fear is, say, being unable to recognize their family, they might choose not to have a risky surgery that could leave them permanently confused, even if it might buy a little more time.
Knowing the fears helps prioritize quality of life defined by the person themselves.
Exactly. Quality over just raw time. Mm-hmm. And then there's the advocacy piece.
Advocating for a loved one who is ill.
Yes. If you find yourself in that situation, talking to doctors, this book really empowers you to change the conversation. Uh-huh. Instead of just asking the default question, what more can be done to keep them alive?
Which is what most people ask, right?
Right. Instead, you need to push further. Ask things like, given what my mother values most, what should we be doing? How will this specific treatment impact her ability to live the kind of life she finds meaningful?
Shifting from can to should based on values.
Precisely. That ensures the medical decisions align with the person's goals, not just the institution's default protocols for treating a disease. It makes you a true advocate for their well-being.
This has been, well, it's a lot to think about, but incredibly important. Thinking about the whole discussion, for me, the biggest takeaway, the final lesson maybe, is that the ultimate failure isn't death itself. Death comes to everyone. Mm. The real failure is allowing someone's final months, weeks, days to be degraded by suffering, by loss of dignity, loss of purpose, especially when so much of that could potentially be prevented.
Prevented through communication.
Through those honest, courageous conversations, acknowledging the limits, defining what matters most.
Yeah, absolutely. And what really surprised me, thinking back, was the sheer power of those seemingly simple solutions, like the Eden alternative.
The animals and plants.
Yeah. The fact that bringing non-medical things, life, responsibility, connection into a sterile environment could so drastically improve well-being, even reduce the need for medications. It's humbling.
It really challenges our reliance on purely technical or pharmaceutical solutions for human problems.
It really does. It shows that care has to be about fostering purpose, community, connection, not just managing physical decline.
It definitely is.
Yeah.
So a final thought, maybe for everyone listening. If Gawande is right, if maintaining our autonomy and purpose is actually more vital to our well-being than just physical safety alone,
yeah.
What calculated risks are you willing to take today, right now, to make sure you stay in control of your own life's story?
That's a powerful question, something for all of us to reflect on.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.